Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3, and this Saturday morning, May 25th, it is time for Final Draft. My name's Andrew Popel, and every week I read lots of books. That's no surprise to anyone who knows me, but then I have the privilege of coming in and speaking with you, speaking with some of the authors of these books, to introduce you to new Australian writing and help you discover more about what's happening in the world of Australian literature. And today on the show, I get to go back to an old favourite. The Roland Sinclair mystery started almost 10 years ago, and Solari Gentile, who is the author of the Roland Sinclair mysteries, now has her ninth in the series. It is called All the Tears in China, and it takes Roland Sinclair to Shanghai in 1935. Fans of the series know that this is not only like some amazingly rollicking mysteries, but it also delves into the political and social climate at the time. So I am really excited to have Solari Gentile joining me on the show today, and we're going to get into the ninth Roland Sinclair mystery, All the Tears in China. It's coming up after this short break.
Visionary, inspired improviser, musical surrealist, African-American artist Lonnie Holly makes his Opera House debut this May for Vivid Live. As mythical as he is musically gifted, Holly was born in racially segregated Birmingham, Alabama, the seventh of 27 children. A self-taught musician, Holly started releasing and performing music in his 60s. His latest release, Myth, was hailed as one of 2018's records of the year. A storyteller of the highest order, immerse yourself in the deeply expressive music of Lonnie Holly on May 31 at Vivid Live. Book now at sydneyoperahouse.com. 2SER sponsors.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. I am Andrew Popel, and dear listener, we are back to enjoy one of my favourite Australian series today. The Roland Sinclair mysteries are now into their ninth adventure. But if you are yet to discover Roland Sinclair and his Scooby gang of artistic lefty crime-solving friends, I have Roland's creator, Solari Gentile, joining me on the phone. Hello, Solari. Welcome. Would you do us the honour of introducing Roland Sinclair?
Hello, Andrew. Absolute pleasure to be here, as always. Roland Sinclair is a young man, a gentleman artist of the 1930s. He walks that fine line between the conservatism of his establishment background and family and the artistic left-wing bohemian sets that he's naturally attracted to amongst his friends. He has the unlucky distinction of coming across dead bodies wherever he goes. And being a young man who actually cares about people and cares about justice, he finds himself embroiled in the solution of these murders from time to time.
And All the Tears in China, the ninth Roland Sinclair mystery, sees Roland, Edna, Milt and Clyde embarking for Shanghai. Now, ostensibly, Roland is there to represent the Sinclairs' business interests at trade negotiations, but it also doesn't hurt that it gets him out of the spotlight and out of the way of the conservative forces that have resented his recent interferences. So there's no spoilers for anyone who is yet to read A Dangerous Language, which was number 8. And I would highly recommend getting back and checking out the mysteries. But we're in Shanghai. Now, this is Roland Sinclair, so of course everything goes smashingly, and they definitely do not discover a dead body in their palatial penthouse suite that throws Roland under a cloud of suspicion with very few friends and a growing collection of enemies. Solari, if we can we start with Shanghai? Because this is a city that's transformed itself numerous times over since the late 1935 setting of All the Tears in China. It has, however, remained this financial and trade hub in the world. What did this location offer for you and offer for Roland in his ongoing adventures?
Well, actually, the decision to move to Shanghai was based, for me, quite politically in some ways. I realised that through the Roland Sinclairs, Sinclair series, what I had been doing is looking at that period between the wars, the 1930s, and part of my interest in that is to look at how we got to the place where we got to with World War II. But I also realised that in looking for those answers, I had always turned my eyes west. And so Roland had always had been to London, and he'd been to America, and of course a lot of the action in the series occurs in Australia. And yet there was this other half of the world which was equally being affected by the growing move towards the right, the growth of fascism, and the undercurrents of turmoil that came through that. And of course in China we saw purges of communists in the early 30s. We see the Japanese coming into Manchuria and absolutely murdering thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And yet, you know, as is so typical even today, quite often what happens in the East is not as personally motivating for us as, you know, some tragedy in the West. And so I very intentionally wanted to move Roland's eyes to the East and have him consider what was going on there. And Shanghai seemed to be the appropriate place for him to go, because not only is it a city that's physically in China, but it's a really interesting city in that it's a treaty port, and so it embodies the world within it. So you have French quarters and German quarters, the British quarters, the Japanese quarters, and so it seemed like the perfect location to actually have a look at how the East and West were wrestling with this change in the political climate.
Now, this feels like less of a black and white book philosophically, if you could describe anything about the first eight books as black and white. What effect did taking my affectionate name, the Scooby Gang, out of the bubble of Australian political and social discourse? What did that challenge you to do with their personal development?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, their personal development kind of matches my own learning about how things are in the world. And quite often you think that you know a topic until you change your perspective and look at it from another point of view. And certainly I didn't know a great deal about the history of Shanghai or China at the time before I started this book. And I was quite surprised to see how much I didn't know. I think one of the things that Roland needs to understand, or what I hope that he would understand out of this book, is that his perspective has been in a bubble. And one of the things that I wanted him to address is that there's a particular point, and it's probably not, well, it probably is a spoiler, but never mind, where one of the other characters asks him why he feels that the Nazis and what they're doing to the socialists and the communists and the Jewish people in Germany, why that's his fight more than any other. Why he cares more about that than he does about the Chinese that were killed in Manchuria, or the American blacks, or even the Aboriginal people in his own country. And it was a question that was asked of Roland. I didn't know the answer, and I still don't think I know the answer. And I just think it's one of those things that people need to address. Everybody chooses their fight. And sometimes we choose our fight for a reason that's just simply because we're not exposed to anything else, or we don't realise what else is out there. It doesn't mean that we'll change our mind and we'll stop fighting for it. It just means that we have to be aware that everything that seems to be everything for us may only be a small part of a greater story. So it was those sort of things that I wanted him to grapple with. Interestingly, in All the Tears in China, I don't think he finds an answer. And I don't think there is an answer to that. I certainly haven't found it for myself. I don't know why some causes are my causes and other causes aren't. It just seems to be something that happens.
I think one of the things that endears us to Roland, but probably also problematizes him, is he at least, I think, very much sees himself as a bit of a white hat type hero in the old mold. And I noticed that as the pace and the action mount in All the Tears in China, Roland finds he's adrift from the money and the influence his family name usually afford him. And those are the things that let him be a white hat hero, because he has this enormous privilege behind him that always cushions him, even though you do knock him about a bit. And in the book, he has to be really careful about who to trust. I noticed it also gave you a chance to expand his entourage. Tell me about what bringing in characters like Wing brought to the story for you.
Wing, well, I was actually, because I was in China, I was very cognizant of not writing a book that was entirely about non-Chinese characters and just using Shanghai as a pretty backdrop. So I wanted to actually look at what a young man in China might have, or in Shanghai might have looked like and what he might have been like. And certainly one of the things that surprised me is that even in the 30s, there was a generation of young men in China who had been sent abroad to study, who had gone to Ivy League schools. And they were the new rich, and then they had come back to China to work and to be captains of industry. So Wing is a highly educated man. He speaks several languages. He is working as a butler in the cafe hotel where Roland is staying, primarily because he may or may not have communist affiliations, and there is a certain protection afforded people who work for Victor Sassoon, who is the owner of that hotel. So he becomes a sidekick or a friend, and he has his own story. I'm quite reticent about making sidekicks that only exist or only have their story in relation to Roland Sinclair. So he certainly has his own life and his own story to live. And of course, he has his he has a nemesis who becomes a friend in the form of Ranjit Singh, who is a Sikh man, and a taxi driver who Roland also manages to adopt while in the middle of a caper. Ranjit Singh equally distrusts Wing Zhao, and they proceed. But the two of them, in some ways, give Roland a foothold into Shanghai's culture, because he's moving blind. He's in this new city, new culture. He doesn't know what he's doing. And sometimes you just need a local to tell you, do that, don't do that.
And yes, this is 2SER. You are tuned into Final Draft, where I'm having a conversation with Solari Gentile about the latest, the ninth, in her Roland Sinclair mystery series. It is called All the Tears in China. Now, there is much more of that conversation to come, but we are going to take a track at the moment. This is new from Underground Lovers, and the track is Passerby.
Just a passerby with the headlights on the interstate. I'm heading east on the way to a place where the sun shines, where the concrete meets jungle green.
Underground Lovers. The track there is Passerby. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. And it's final draft time. Final draft means books, writing and literary culture. Every week I bring you new Australian books, new Australian writers, and we chat and we discover more about, why you should be reading the books, why we love these books, what's going on in Australia's literary culture. And today I am joined by Solari Gentile. She is the author of the incredibly popular, incredibly successful, one of my favourite, the Roland Sinclair Mysteries. Number 9 in the series is All the Tears in China, and Roland Sinclair has found himself in Shanghai in 1935. So another important element of the novel are the ways that Roland has to check himself and also adjust to being part of these multiple intersecting interests that are all converging on the world stage in Shanghai. We've talked about Roland's bubble in Australia. But here I want to bring in the violence, because you do good violence and you do good violence to Roland. For a moment there, I thought you were actually going to let him off the hook. And then, wow, you really ramped it up. Was it difficult to strike a balance with Roland?
Oh, you know, after every single book, I get letters from people berating me about how hard I am on Roland.
Are you actually worried that you've maybe given him a concussion, and like at some point you're going to have to write the results of
that? Well, I'm really careful. I don't give him head injuries. you will see that I don't give him head injuries.
He's too pretty. You'd have to answer to Edna.
Yes. Well, I think part of it's interesting and it's endearing and it's quite lovely that Roland has a bevy of fans who are so motivated to protect him that they will write to me to ask me to be kinder to him in the next novel. But one of the things that I keep saying to them is that Roland knew when he signed up for the gig that he was going to be a crime fiction hero. And you know, it's a rough gig. nobody wants to read about Roland sitting safely in the parlour knitting.
It struck me in All the Tears in China, though, he's throwing himself into conflicts where, again, he's not assured of being the white hat hero. Even in the sort of he's escaping and he goes into a bar without really thinking that his veneer as a gentleman would perhaps not protect them. And there was a sense that even though Edna was under threat, he was quite a bit in the wrong in the way that all washed out. His recklessness really didn't serve him well.
No, and you know, the thing is that Roland is not a perfect character. Mm. He is not, as a human being, someone who always makes the right decision. Mm. And certainly in this situation where he's in a new country, he hasn't got the usual structures that he can rely on behind him. He's in a place where people actually don't care who a Sinclair is. Mm. So he's probably just a little bit wrong-footed the whole book. He has an impulsive need to go in and protect, but he sometimes should stop and think about the consequences of his actions and how they're going to play out in the long run. And certainly that's something that's just part of his development and part of him growing up that he needs to learn. In All the Tears in China, he was also thrown off balance by the fact that there was the sub-story where there's a threat to Edna. And, you know, for him, it's difficult, and it's difficult to look at it through modern eyes where we understand that women can make their own decisions and protect themselves. Mm. But his overwhelming training as a gentleman of the 1930s was to protect and to stand up for. So it's one of those things that he's got to learn about Edna.
And hopefully she's not going to have to shoot him again to make him realise.
Well, if she needs to, she will.
Now, coming back to the group at large, Milton and Clyde's politics have always featured in the book's broader philosophy. And as part of, I guess, our heroic team, we're invited to see the nobility that's inherent in their socialist sensibilities, at least. But in All the Tears, we have an existential crisis brewing. Both men are confronted with the murky realities of what's happening to communists in China.
In Russia.
What's happening, what communists are doing, but then also what's happening to communists in other parts of the world. And they're troubled. I see some of the brashness sort of taken away from them, and much as Roland is forced to confront his ideology, so are they. How do you see these personal conflicts playing out in those relationship dynamics for the four?
Well, look, it's an interesting... In some ways, Milton and Clyde have served as Roland's conscience, or at least his social conscience. He's always been a very principled man, and he's always, you know, valued and held on to things like loyalty and friendship and kindness. But really, in terms of social principles, it's been Clyde and Milton who have been his social conscience. Mm. But what Milton is faced with in this is what is happening to communism in China and around the world, but more so what communism is doing. So the home or the centre of the communist utopia, Russia, is not cloaking itself in glory at all. And certainly there is a Jewish doctor who wrote this when Milton initially speaks to him. He's assuming that the man has fled Germany, and he mentions that there are just as many people fleeing Russia. Mm. And so it's an interesting look at how dictatorship on both sides can lead to the same ends. And totalitarianism is totalitarianism, regardless of whether it comes from the left or the right. In terms of how it affects their... I mean, I think one of the wonderful things about this four is that they have allowed each other to be. So Milton doesn't ever try to turn Roland into a communist, and he doesn't ever try to turn them away, however convenient it would be for each of them to pull the other one a little bit closer to their own ideology. I think Roland has to, in this book, Roland has to try and define or defines more closely where he actually stands, who he is. And he's not a communist. He's never been a communist. But there's certain principles that he shares with Milton and Clyde. And there's certain underlying morals, a certain underlying moral code that he feels is very consistent. He certainly admires them. I think he probably just really feels that they're a bit unrealistic in their belief in humanity. And I remember hearing that old phrase that, you know, anyone who isn't a communist when they're 21 hasn't got a heart. Anyone who's still a communist when they're 30 hasn't got a brain.
Yeah.
And I think it's that tension. As much as, you know, Clyde and Milton dream of this communist utopia, and they are really idealistic about that. And as much as they call Roland romantic, and he sees that they have a greater belief in humanity than he does.
Discover, dear listener, where the story takes Solari. I am speaking with Solari Gentile. We are discussing book 9 in the Roland Sinclair Mysteries. It is called All the Tears in China. If you are new to the Roland Sinclair Mysteries, then know that you have such a treat ahead of you. Solari, thank you so much for taking the time once again.
Absolute pleasure, Andrew. Thank you very much for having me.
Get it together, Sydney. The studio parties return to rinse the club clean across 4 euphoric nights from Friday, May 24 at the Opera House for Vivid Live. 2 of the world's most cutting-edge electronic DJs get the subs rattling when Berlin-based American composer Lauren Halo headlines alongside rising K-House star Park Ye-jin. The iconic British house music architect, a guy called Gerald, brings 3 decades of game-changing beats on May 25, followed by Barcelona's DJ extraordinaire John Talabot on May 31. Taking out the parties on June 1 is Germany's legendary techno innovator Moritz von Oswald. Book now for the studio parties at Vivid Live on May 24, 25, 31 and June 1 at sydneyoperahouse.com. 2SER sponsors.
This is 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and I'm back to say goodbye because it's almost the end of Final Draft. Thank you again to Solari Gentile, who joined me. We were discussing number 9 in the Roland Sinclair Mysteries. It is called All the Tears in China, and if you missed any of that, if you want to actually hear an extended version of that conversation, get over to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, you know, iTunes, Spotify, any number of podcatchers, just copy the RSS feed into it. You will find almost 50 great books and many more bonus interviews. In fact, we're almost up to our 50th episode. We've been going for almost a year. I want to know your favorite episode. And the way I want you to tell me, go back and re-listen to your favorite episode. As we come up to the anniversary of the Final Draft podcast, I'm going to announce some of the most popular books from the podcast series. Right now, though, I'm going to leave you with a track from Melbourne singer-songwriter Lucy Roloff. The Vulture's Nest is coming up in just a few minutes. This is from Lucy Roloff. It is called Autumn Song. I'm Andrew Popel. I'll see you next week. Till then, happy reading.
Season begin, heavy quilts and the trees darkening, auburn and red and gold. Chimneys puff plumes into the eve, leaving the city to sleep. Something to do with the light seeping in underneath the door. Picks my dreams up and flips them around. Passing the hatchet to you, leaning the firewood to dry upon the porch. I believe in this alpine red bottle brush and the sun.